On the front of your bulletin, I have a picture from the 1970s of the Gucci family. The Gucci family has been making leather goods ever since the 16th century. They crafted a business in 1906. Just as a side note, we in the session considered giving the new host of new members Gucci bags. But then we realized we'd have to fire Kevin to pay for it. So we chose something else. You're welcome. You're welcome. I'm looking out for you, babe. It's all about career advancement. The Guccis, again, are a family business. They've been doing it for 500 years. And in 1906, they formed a company. And by 1960, they had to sell the company because of backbiting and fury and deception and suits and lawsuits and countersuits, such that now it's owned by some French firm, right? That's what happens, right? Gucci family is actually quite common, that phenomenon. There are all sorts of companies that you may not have known of were family businesses. Oracle, Samsung, here's a shocker, Walmart, right? In-N-Out Burger. I mean, there's a whole host of family businesses out there. But what happened to Gucci is apparently very common. The statistics for people who count like this, only a third of family businesses make it into the third generation. 12% make it into the fourth generation. 3% into the fifth generation. It's just the way things are. Family businesses, you would think, would hold together. We're family, for goodness sake. But ironically enough, family businesses, either the family loses the business or the business loses the family. It's the way things are. For those of you who are only now joining us in this sermon series, we're in a sermon series on the Sermon on the Mount. And we're arguing that Jesus is saying not just a set of ethics for us to indoctrinate ourselves in or to embrace. We believe that Jesus is out to reimagine life for us. Reimagine the very shape of life, the very depth of life, the very foundations of life. That's what Jesus is out to do. And as I was meditating upon the text that we're going to look at this week, this metaphor of a family business came to mind. Because in a beatitude that we're going to listen to today, it will prescribe something for us, kind of like what a business does. A business has a goal. It has an aspiration. It's out to flourish. Jesus is out to prescribe something for us, but he situates what he prescribes for us in the context of being one who is identified with his family. So this idea of a family business kind of came to mind as I was looking at this text, and as I proceeded to consider it further, I think this text is going to tell us three things. What is our family business if we're of the family of God? Why is it a family business? And then thirdly, what grooms us for this family business? What is this family business? Why is it a family business? And what grooms us for this family business? We're going to hear from Jedediah Lafferty. He's going to recite the Beatitude for us, but not until you are all standing and giving him your full attention. Would you? Thank you.
Blessed are the peacemakers, for they shall be called children of God. This is the word of the Lord.
Thanks be to God.
You may be seated.
Practice makes perfect. This is the seventh of the eight Beatitudes that we're considering one by one. They, if you will, form the sum and substance of what he's going to elaborate on for the rest of the Sermon on the Mount. The rest of the Sermon on the Mount is pretty much him riffing on the themes that we are exposing one per week. The Beatitudes are in themselves blessings. That's what Beatitude means. That's why every Beatitude starts with blessed are. And what we've said from week to week is that these Beatitudes are characterizations of someone who considers themselves a follower of Jesus, who considers themselves part of the family of Jesus, who is a member of that family. And therefore, the question we have to ask is, if to follow Jesus is to be family to him, then what might we say is the family business, so to speak? This will not be a shock to you because you just heard it. What is our family business? Brothers and sisters, if you're a member of the household of God, then your family business is making peace. That's your gig. That's your calling. That's your vocation. Gucci makes bags. In-N-Out makes burgers. Walmart makes everything for 17 cents. But the family of God, they make peace. Now, as soon as I say that, it asks any number of questions. What do we mean? First of all, what do we mean by peace? Okay? We shouldn't just assume that we know what we mean by that. So let's clarify what we mean by peace if we're going to understand what peacemaking is. And to that, we have to understand what does the Bible mean by the word peace? At a bare minimum, you might say that peace is the absence of war, the cessation of hostility, and you would be right. But that is not the entirety of what the Bible means by peace. Where there aren't parties that are antagonizing one another, where aggression has been tamped down, you have something like peace, and therefore nations will forge peace treaties as a mutual commitment to end the war. But in the biblical lexicon, peace is more than the absence of hostility. Peace has to do with fellowship. Where there is peace, there is more than a refusal to fight. There is a desire to engage, to befriend, to share, to commune together. That's peace. In the Old Testament, you know the word for peace. It's shalom. In the New Testament, the Greek word is eirene. And they connote more than just non-aggression. They connote a fruitful participation in one another's lives. That's peace. So how does that shape our understanding of what peace making is? Well, to do that, we need to kind of clear away some things that you might associate with peacemaking, which are not the center of what peacemaking is. And the first thing you have to kind of clear away is the idea that peacemaking is not to be confused with peacekeeping. Not peacekeeping in the modern sense of the word. You know what the UN is? You know, peacekeepers. They're there to dissuade aggressors from taking back up their rocks and stones and swords and IEDs. That's what peacekeepers do. Theirs is an act of deterrence. It's an attempt to preempt war more than it is trying to foster communion between parties. And therefore, peacekeeping is not the same thing as peacemaking. Secondly, peacemaking is not the same thing as peace loving, as good as peace loving might be. You can appreciate peace. You can hope that non-aggression will persist and flourish into communion. You can even rejoice where you see peace starting to take hold. But peace loving is essentially a passive posture. It may champion peace. It may post articles on Facebook about peace. Look at where peace is reigning. It's on Upworthy. Don't you love it? But peace loving is not the same thing as peacemaking. And there's a third thing that you need to distinguish peacemaking from, and it's this. It's not strict pacifism either. Now, I don't mean pacifism sort of in the geopolitical sense. I'm talking more in the interpersonal sense. The idea that there ought never be any confrontation or hostility, that you ought never raise your voice or challenge a position or confront a person. That's sort of a pacifistic frame of mind. It's sort of a temperament. If you and I hate being in conflict, if we hate even more so trying to restore not just order but fellowship, then we will avoid conflict altogether. And we will embrace sort of this, as I said, temperamental pacifism. That's not peacemaking. Jesus says in Matthew 10, "Do not think that I have come to bring peace to the earth. I've not come to bring peace, but a sword." Now, from that sort of enigmatic and metaphorical comment alone, we see that clearly Jesus is not just espousing peace for the sake of peace. His peacemaking has a nuance to it. Okay, we spent enough time talking about what peacemaking isn't. Now let's talk about what peacemaking is. This is peacemaking. Peacemaking is an active interest and effort to bring a true reconciliation that yields new relationship. whether that is between you and somebody else you're alienated with, or between two parties with whom you have some relationship. Peacemaking is seeking to bring a true reconciliation that yields new relationship. That's peacemaking. That's why Paul will say to the church at Rome in his letter, let us pursue what makes for peace and for mutual upbuilding. It's not just an end to hostility, brothers and sisters. It's an effort to see that two parties are seen to one another's good, to their upbuilding. But therein lies the question. How do you do that? What makes for peace that makes for upbuilding? Let's just talk about it at a very practical level so far. At the practical level, peace has a chance when everybody that's at war actually wants to find peace, which is no small thing. Unless both antagonistic parties have some interest, even the feeblest of desire, to be in league with one another instead of at war, peace is only a pipe dream until they both want it. At a practical level, there has to be a mutual willingness, therefore, to reconsider the other's view and one's own view that has led to discord. The absence of peace, I think you would agree, is really a function of two ideas, of two storylines, of two views, of two sets of assumptions that have collided. And they've become intractable in the minds of those who are at odds with one another. And therefore, the only hope for peace ever to reign from a very practical point of view is a reevaluation of those two views. Or at least seeing some third way of seeing things that make those two opposing views not seem so important anymore. Even at that practical level, making for peace is difficult work. John Calvin conceded that, quote, it is a laborious and irksome employment to reconcile those who are at variance. Persons of a mild disposition who study to promote peace are compelled to endure the indignity of hearing reproaches, of complaints, and remonstrances on all sides. And you know what? Calvin was very familiar with it. Back in his day, there was this thing called the consistory. It was like a session. And every day it would hear disputes from people across the city. And the session was compiled and commissioned to work through in that peace. So they knew what it was like to hear, to listen, to weigh, and to help two parties try to come to harmony and communion again. The emotional courage it takes to sift through that kind of stuff may make it feel like a daunting task. The investment of time just to hear people out, to consider both views. Can you see why we might call this a business, right? Businesses don't function on autopilot. Businesses don't flourish naturally. Businesses naturally decay. So does peace. You might be surprised to learn. Two of my favorite authors, C.S. Lewis and J.R.R. Tolkien. You know, C.S. Lewis is the Narnian. Tolkien is the Middle-earth dude. They were part of that same literary club in England called the Inklings. They lived estranged from one another for years, even up to the point of C.S. Lewis's death. Tolkien, you might know, was instrumental in C.S. Lewis coming to faith in Jesus. They walked on Addison's Road, and Tolkien spoke with Lewis about why Jesus is trustworthy, and something clicked in the midst of those conversations. But it was a burr in Tolkien's saddle that C.S. Lewis never went fully Roman Catholic, but stayed within the Church of England. And it was a burr in Tolkien's saddle that when C.S. Lewis marries Joyce Gresham, that he didn't even tell Tolkien. And for years, they lived estranged. Even when Tolkien visits Lewis on his deathbed, their conversations kept to matters of literary interest. Instead of peace and true communion, they preferred something more like détente. Peacemaking is hard work. And that's especially true for you if you're a party to the dispute. And you kind of already know that, but let me kind of unpack for you why that's true. It will always be easier to view somebody that's an adversary like an abstraction, to define them by the argument that they have with you, rather than see them as somebody who is made in the image of God and therefore has a dignity irrespective of how much you despise what they stand for. You know why else it's hard to be involved in a row with somebody? Because there's pain involved in seeking to make peace. That pain exists in degrees, kind of depending on the makeup of the person that's seeking to make peace. But anyone who is out to bring reconciliation has to enter into pain, because it often means facing somebody that doesn't want to reconcile. It often means facing somebody that would just be fine if you remained estranged, and who, when you approach them to even hazard reconciliation, they look at you with contempt. Brothers and sisters, that ain't easy. Nobody likes doing that. And that's just the practical challenge of making peace. And those practical challenges alone make two things clear about this form of peacemaking. One, peacemaking is ultimately a matter of the heart. And two, the making of peace at times means going to war. If we might just restate what Jesus says there in Matthew 10, I did not come to bring peace but a sword. He's employing metaphor there. And he's employing metaphor to speak of an interest in changing hearts, even if it means sowing discord between those who were formerly in harmony and communion. And when the Apostle Paul tells the church at Ephesus, our war is not against flesh and blood, but against the principalities and the powers, he's saying that our battlefield is in the heart. And that battlefield has forces arrayed that are both within the heart and beyond the world. And unless we're willing to go to war for that peace, we're never going to know the peace that can be ours. Now, all of those abstractions and all of those high-sounding arguments are begging for an illustration. I'm going to give you one that's pretty hard. Waco has been in the news for other reasons this week, but it just so happens that 100 years ago, last week in Waco, Texas, a 17-year-old black man by the name of Jesse Washington was burned and beaten. He was charged with murder, but using ambiguous evidence to substantiate the charge. The trial was hastily concluded, but before the system could appreciate or execute a sentence, a mob grabbed him and decided to take justice into their own hands. They lynched him. They subjected him to all forms of degradation. That's 1920s Texas. In 1950s and 1960s America, the powers that be thought that the way to make peace was through segregation, offering separate but equal provisions. Surely that would be an olive branch. Brothers and sisters, that was a form of peace, but which was not on the basis of a true peace. For true peace to emerge, there had to be a willingness to confront the way things were, but in a nonviolent way. This was a war not just for equal treatment. This was a war for the hearts of men. And because it was for the hearts of men and not just for equality in itself, the weapons it chose was as crucial as the peace that it sought. And that's why that movement that pressed for peace in that way had emblazoned upon their hearts what Jesus says at Gethsemane when they're arresting him. If you live by the sword, you will die by the sword. And so the peace that that movement sought was by means of a very careful war. And what we find in that era, and what we will find the need of in every area, brothers and sisters, that's our family business. It functions at the interpersonal level. It functions at the ethnic level. It functions at the geopolitical level. But that, if you're his and part of his family, is your family business. And some of you are thinking, tell you what, sounds too hard. I think I'd like to find work in another field. Jesus is not letting us off the hook here, though. It's a family business in which everyone in the family is employed. So this is my second point that I want to raise with you. Why should we call it a family business? What makes it a family business? The reason I'm harping on this metaphor is because this is the only beatitude in the entirety of the Beatitudes in which Jesus situates a characteristic of the follower with their identity as one related to the family. For him to say, "Blessed are the peacemakers, for they shall be called sons of God," he is grounding our mandate to seek peace in who we are to God, in who God is in himself. And therefore, peacemaking is a family business because the head of the family has sought peace, if you will, from the day he founded the company, so to speak. If I can press that metaphor just a little further, at the very article of incorporation of all things, at the creation, God sought not just to be a creator and then go into his corner and let humanity do as it would. He fought to forge peace. He fought to forge communion with them. That's peace. And when that peace was lost, when something happened in humanity that made it believe that it was better off doing things on its own terms and didn't need the Lord to give any insight or lay down any kind of stipulations for what it meant to find the life of flourishing, when that peace was lost, God sought to forge a new peace. And at first with a particular family, but always with a view to peace in the whole world. The decision to bless Israel, who would come through Abraham, was a peace to make Israel a source of blessing so that they could be a source of blessing unto the whole world. And that meant a source of peace. That's the plan that God outlines to Abraham. But if you follow the unfolding of that plan, if you follow the storyline of the Bible, then you know that the very ones who had been commissioned to bring peace to the world were the ones who found themselves at war with one another. Israel gets split into two antagonizing nations, a northern kingdom and a southern kingdom, and they suffer exile as a result of their lack of peace between one another. And you hear the Lord often and early and always speak of reunion and speak of peace. Brothers and sisters, what is God doing in Psalm 87 when he lists all of these nations that formerly were antagonistic to Israel, but he says, "This one shall be found to have been born in Zion." Because he means to bring peace to the entirety of the world. But he has to start with the nation who was commissioned to bring peace, but unfortunately had sacrificed it. And you hear that across the Old Testament, and you hear that especially in the prophets. And in Zechariah chapter 9, Zechariah speaks of someone that would come to bring peace between the northern and southern kingdom of Israel, which had been racked with strife. And in Zechariah 9, it says this: "I will cut off the chariot from Ephraim and the war horse from Jerusalem, and the battle bow shall be cut off, and he shall speak peace to the nations. He shall rule from sea to sea and from the river to the ends of the earth." What's Zechariah talking about there? He's talking about somebody that would bring an end to hostilities between the northern and the southern kingdom of Israel. But he's also talking about somebody that would speak peace to the nations, who would bring some kind of word that creates and seals a peace, not just within Israel, but with a view to the whole earth. This is the one who's in the family business. This is the scion of the Father. He would take the business model that he'd gotten from God and see to perpetuating the mission throughout the entirety of the earth. So who's this dude? Who's this one coming to bring peace? I read you Zechariah 9, verse 10. Now I'm going to read you Zechariah 9, verse 9. Rejoice greatly, O daughter of Zion. Shout aloud, O daughter of Jerusalem. Behold, your king is coming to you. Righteous and having salvation is he. Humble and mounted on a donkey, on a colt, the foal of a donkey. The one who would bring peace to Israel, the one who would speak peace to all nations, is the same one who's going to ride into Jerusalem humbly on a donkey. A king would come, a king like a son to God, and it's that king who would take up the work that God had given him. And if you have followed Old Testament prophecy and know what it happens at, towards the end of every gospel, then you know who that king riding humbly on a donkey into Jerusalem is. It's the one we know as Jesus. And in living out his calling as not just a son of God, he's carrying out the family business because he's a son of the Father. But in doing so, brothers and sisters, he's not just modeling the family business. He's grooming us for it. How does he? That's where I'm going to land this plane. If our family business is peacemaking, and it's a family business because it has everything to do with your identity as being a part of his family, then how does he groom us for it? By coming to terms with three things. The lengths to which the Son goes to bring peace. The incarnation speaks of one who would leave everything that was familiar and glorious to him to enter into squalor, to enter into poverty, to enter into degradation, to enter into ridicule, to enter into persecution. He would do that. He would be subject to all manner of limitations and subject to all manner of threats, verbal, social, and otherwise. He would enter into abuse to bring peace. Why would that groom us for the family business? Because in coming to terms with the lengths to which he did, to which he went to bring peace, it impresses upon us the centrality of being those who make peace. What he did at the cross, the peace he came to bring, was not peripheral. It was central. It was his priority. And therefore, us to think that making peace is somehow for somebody else to do, or that it's a luxury item, or it's for the hyper-spiritual, misses the point of what Jesus really came to do. What he, the lengths that he went to, impresses upon us the priority of making peace. You can't detach Jesus' making peace from himself, and therefore you can't detach our identity as children of God from those who are out to make peace. You have to reckon with the lengths to which he went to bring peace. You also have to grasp the depths to which this peace reaches. The peace that Jesus sought to bring was an inner peace, a poise that enables us to face a threatening world. And that peace that he sought yields a peace with us so that it might yield a peace with those with whom we're in relationship. But both the inward and outward peace derive from the depth to which his peacemaking was ordered. And what I mean by that is that the peace that Jesus sought was not just between you and me. It was the peace that Jesus sought between us and God. And a peace that was not out just to end hostilities so that God was off our backs. But it was a peace where we might live in communion with him and might enjoy him and might flourish on account of knowing him. So we ask the question again, well, why would that groom us for the family business of peacemaking? It does this because when you grasp what peace he came to do for us, when you see the depths to which it goes, then it undercuts your two reasons why you're not interested in making peace. You know why you don't want to make peace? Sometimes it's because it's out of pride. You think, they're not worth it. And I'm not going to go to the trouble of doing that. and I'm too important to let myself be inconvenienced by the call to making peace. Brothers and sisters, if you have no peace with God apart from the peace that Jesus sought from you, then you are arrogating to yourself an importance that is not yours. His peace humbles us enough so that we will not use pride as an excuse not to pursue peace. But here's the other reason why you and I are afraid of making peace. We're afraid of what we might feel or lose as a consequence of trying. We're afraid of what it's going to feel like to face somebody that may not want peace from me. Brothers and sisters, even if your efforts to make peace go south, even if it's a failure, even if it takes a decade for peace to be found, whatever you might not gain in that process will never be equal to what you gain in the peace that you found from the Lord Jesus, in the peace that you have now with God. Both pride and fear are why we don't pursue for peace, but what Jesus does for us in the depths of finding peace undercuts those reasons so that we might live with an effort to find peace. There's one other reason that His peace grooms us for this business. It's because He's entirely nonspecific in who He means for us to make peace with. He just says, "Blessed are the peacemakers," which means that this business model applies without limitation. The sky's the limit on who He might have in mind for us to seek peace with, whether it's with our friends or with our spouse, whether it's with our children, whether it's with our bosses or our employees, whether it's with our neighbors, whether it's between ethnicities and nations and peoples. As Paul puts it, if possible, so far as it depends on you, live peaceably with all. Brothers and sisters, that's how He grooms us for this business model. Let me close like this. There was a day where if you were a child of a business person, mother or father, you took almost a reflexive pride in following in their footsteps. There were a lot more family businesses a long time ago than there are now, because you were esteemed if you did the same thing your mom or dad did. And in present circumstances, though, there's a cultural construct out there called expressive individualism. And the narrative goes like this: you're only going to find your life until you find your life on your own, quite apart from whatever your mom or dad did. And therefore, the idea of following the family business almost sounds like a failure. Brothers and sisters, it may feel at times like this call of the family business is something you're not cut out for and something that you don't want to go for. But Jesus is saying that the family business of peacemaking is everybody's business who's in the family of God. And not only is it everybody's business, it's everybody's privilege. Far from peacemaking being a stifling, soul-numbing experience, Jesus is saying it's a blessing. So I ask you, with whom is it within your power this day to live peaceably, but with whom you are not presently living peaceably? It's really easy to go to corners. It's a lot harder to seek peace, but there is blessing in it, and He commends that blessing to us. Family business, the work is hard. Benefits are over the top. In the name of the Father, and of the Son, and of the Holy Spirit. Amen.